Good morning. My name's Ruth. I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm going to be talking this morning for a little bit about one of the perspectives that we have on God. For those of you who've not been here for the past few weeks, we're in the middle of a series called God Partial Perspectives. And through this series, we're kind of digging into some of the different ways that we think about and understand and engage with God. We all come from different backgrounds, we've all got different temperaments and personalities and different ways of viewing the world, and so none of us has got a complete picture on God, but we all have a unique experience of God, and so through this series we want to understand more from each other and from these different perspectives to have a richer, more diverse, deeper understanding of God. I think that's one of the great things of being in a diverse community, being able to see God in one another in very different ways and being able to learn about God through one another's eyes, so learning together. So the title of today's message is God of Integrity. What do we mean by integrity? I think integrity is one of those things that you realize when it's not there more than you do when it is there. We live in a society that I think desperately seems to be lacking in integrity. People in positions of prominence, whether that's celebrities or corporate executives or church leaders or whoever that is, so often turn out to be deeply flawed, morally flawed, hypocrites even. We've seen it in the media pretty much on a daily basis. At the end of the year, you get those lists. I was looking at some of those. You get the top-selling movies and best books and all that kind of stuff. And there were a couple on scandals, most outrageous scandals or the ones that got the tweeted the most or things like that. And I thought, I'll start with showing one of those. But it was so depressing. You go through a year's worth of scandals. And how many times we've seen high-ranking politicians from both sides of the divide turn out to be corrupt or liars or, we've seen sexual abuse in every part of society, whether that's, Hollywood or corporate executives or the church again. We've seen lots of violence, people of color being treated with violence by the police, just at every level of society, just deep, deep lack of integrity. And even on a more trivial level, we see our trust undermined, by things like Russian bots that are manipulating our social media feeds or, companies selling our data. Or even the Bible Museum was exposed as exhibiting forgeries. I mean, if you can't trust the Bible Museum, who can you trust? But it's just everywhere. Everywhere you look, there seems to be a real lack of integrity. And in fact, even the word integrity kind of sounds a little quaint or a little old-fashioned. It's like decency or virtue. It's kind of not really a word we use even all that much. So what is integrity? Well, integrity comes from the Latin word integritas, which means wholeness, completeness, a state of being undivided. It's where we get the word integer from, for a whole number. So it's a wholeness, a consistency of character. It's about not having a disconnect between our values and what we actually say and do. It's about thinking and speaking and acting from our values rather than from personal gain. Integrity is not something that's externally imposed. It's not about being kept in line. It's about an internal wholeness, an internal consistency that leads us to making good moral and ethical choices. C.S. Lewis famously said, "Integrity is doing the right thing even when no one is watching." And I think most of us really long for integrity. We want to be people that have integrity. We want to be whole. We want to be consistent. We don't want to be hypocrites. We don't want to be full of deception or deceiving ourselves. We want to have integrity. I think we want it in our personal relationships. We want to know that we can trust people. We want to not worry about feeling betrayed or let down. And we want it in society. Integrity is actually a big buzzword in the corporate world because it appeals to us. It does, even though it sounds a little old-fashioned, there is something about integrity. It sounds like a good thing. Probably most of us remember the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. In 2004, Viktor Yushchenko ran for president, and he was vehemently opposed by the ruling party. And During his election campaign, he was mysteriously poisoned, and it left him with a... He nearly died, but one of the lasting effects was this facial disfigurement. So it was a very corrupt regime, a very controlling regime, and the election was widely seen as rigged, and sure enough, the media came back and said that he had lost, even though the exit polls had shown him winning by a considerable margin. So 3 days after the election, when there was an official announcement on the state-run main channel, UT1, that indeed the sitting president had been re-elected, Natalia Dmytruk, well, this is not a very clear picture, but she was in the bottom corner signing for the deaf. And so the announcement was read that the president had won again, been re-elected, but instead of following the official script, she instead signed this: "I'm addressing everyone who is deaf in Ukraine. Our president is Viktor Yushchenko. Do not trust the results of the Central Election Committee. They are all lies. And I'm very ashamed to translate such lies to you. Maybe you will see me again." And this brave act inspired 250 of her colleagues at UT1 to go on strike immediately. And very soon, other journalists joined in. They also started reporting some of the irregularities at the polls, and other people joined in. And very quickly, this became a big movement and led to the downfall. It led to the Orange Revolution, which led to the downfall of the ruling party. But I think, if you could put that picture back up, I think this is a great picture of what integrity is. Natalia Dmytruk couldn't control the whole screen. She couldn't control the script that was being read. But in her corner, where she did control, she was going to stay true to what she saw as being true, to her values. She was, even though she thought it would probably have a very big cost for her. And actually, that ended up making a huge difference. So I think that's a good kind of picture for us of what integrity is about. Jesus, of course, is our ultimate model of integrity. Jesus shows us what a God of integrity looks like. We read in Hebrews 1, "The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being." I like how the Message version translates that. "The Son perfectly mirrors God and is stamped with God's nature." Jesus himself said, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." So if we want to know what a God of integrity looks like, we can look at Jesus. And the gospel accounts of Jesus' life show us someone who really lived his values rather than living for personal gain. I think the story of Jesus being tempted in the wilderness is perhaps the kind of the classic example of Jesus refusing to take the easy way out of living a way that would benefit him, and instead, not using his powers that way, but really living out his values. We read that story a few weeks ago, you might remember, at Epiphany. And it's a well-known story. We're not going to read it today. But temptation, of course, is not just kind of this one-off thing. It's something that we face every day and something that I'm sure Jesus struggled with every day, just like we all do. But that temptation story in the Gospels, I think, is interesting because it's kind of presented in very stark terms. I think we've got a few paintings too that kind of illustrate this. You can look at the same time. But Jesus is tempted by the devil, we're told. And there are wild animals prowling around. And then on the other side, we have these angels. So it's presented, I think, deliberately in a kind of a confrontational, adversarial kind of way. It's a battle between good and evil, light and darkness. I think we all have times where temptation can be like that, where there's a very clear way that we could do something that would be to our own advantage, but we know it's not right. And it's clearly not the right thing to do, and then there's the other thing that we could do. And I think in some ways, situations like that are fairly easy to deal with. We kind of, know how we should respond. If you think, oh, this is the devil tempting me, well, clearly, you know how to respond. A few years ago, I was asked to provide some input on a multi-million-dollar contract that the government was putting out, where there was a clear conflict of interest. My firm was actually bidding on it, and if I had been asked, responded to the invitation to intervene in the way that I was being asked, we probably would have won it, but it was a clear conflict of interest. So I said, I can't do that, and explain why. And the government representative said, "Oh, Ruth's a good woman." And I was so proud of that. Yes, I'm a good woman. But it wasn't true, because it was so obviously a conflict of interest. If I'd got found out, it would have been I would have been in serious trouble, you know. So those kind of things actually can end up being kind of easy choices. But unfortunately, I think a lot of the time, temptation is much less obvious than that. I think, you know, we get tired, we get cranky, we don't really want to be bothered doing what we know we should do, but it's kind of a little thing anyway, maybe it doesn't matter. We don't want to go the extra mile, we snap back at the person who's mean to us, or we, you know, we say something that's not technically 100% true, but, you know, we've all been in those situations. We've probably all read the Sermon on the Mount, that wonderful summary of Jesus' teachings in which we're told to love our enemies and give generously to those in need and not judge other people and be true to our word and, you know, all those kind of things. And we know that. We know what we should do. But on a daily basis, sometimes it can seem like a little bit too much effort. You know, why should I try my best when not everybody else seems to? Why shouldn't I get mad and yell at people and act out while other people do that? Why shouldn't I join in gossip? It's not really hurting anyone. You know those kind of things? They're not, you know, showdowns with the devil. This is not a cosmic battle between good and evil, maybe. I don't think it's even necessarily a decisive test of our character. But each of those little interactions can represent a disconnect between our values and how we actually live out our life. It represents a lack of wholeness, a lack of consistency, a lack of integrity. And we don't see that in Jesus. Jesus taught repeatedly that we need to love everyone, no exceptions. And we read towards the end of Jesus' life these amazing verses in Luke's gospel. When they came to the place called the skull, they crucified him there along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on the left. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." These are amazing words. Jesus forgiving people as in the very act of them putting him to death. But this strikes me as one of those cosmic moments, right? This is the good versus evil. How will you react in the most extreme circumstances? I think something that, for me, speaks more of Jesus' integrity is this story in Mark 6. The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all that they had done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. Jesus and his disciples had got every right to take time away, right? To eat, to rest, to not have to be on, not have to be teaching people all the time, there for people all the time. It wasn't selfish to want to get away. I think, you know, actually it was very sensible to want to do that. But when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion. He loved them. It wasn't fair that they were asking him to do yet more teaching when he'd been doing that all the time. He was tired, he was hungry, but he had compassion. It wasn't to do with what was fair, what was right. It wasn't about what the law says. It wasn't even about social obligations. This is just compassion. Jesus loved them and responded to their need. I think we see another example of this kind of integrity in the story of Jesus when he's been resurrected on the beach with Peter, Simon Peter. He has both those names. And when Jesus, as you may remember, was arrested and was being tried by the religious authorities, Peter, or Simon Peter, actually denied even knowing Jesus. He did that three times. Said he didn't even know him. He wasn't one of the followers. And after Jesus' death and resurrection, Jesus meets with some of his disciples on the beach. And it seems that he goes for a walk with Peter and has this one-on-one conversation. And I think if I was in Jesus' sandals, I would have responded to Peter in one of two ways. I think I would have either, you know, really let him have it. You know, you betrayed me in my hour of need. You know, what kind of a person are you, kind of a thing. Or maybe I just wouldn't really have said anything, been a little bit more distant, just kind of thought to myself, well, I'll remember that I can't trust you next time. But Jesus doesn't respond in either of those ways. This is what Jesus says. So when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him a third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. Jesus provides Peter with something of a do-over here. He gives him an opportunity to reaffirm his love three times. And Peter knows what's going on. You know, it's the third time. It's pretty obvious what Jesus is doing here. And it's hurtful, but at the same time, it brings it out in the open. And Jesus takes the opportunity to reaffirm his trust in Peter, his confidence in him. Again, this has nothing to do with what was right, the right thing to do necessarily, or fair or just. It's about love. What was the loving thing to do? Being honest and talking about this, but in a way that is just so full of love. In the Sermon on the Mount, which we just mentioned earlier, Jesus famously said that his followers should be salt and light, and that we should be careful not to hide our light or not to lose our saltiness. Society needs salt and needs light. Salt gives flavor. It's a preservative. It's necessary for life. And we see this light, we see this salt in Jesus consistently. Jesus lived a life that was full of love. Love that, I think we have a slide for that. Love that reached out to everyone, reached out to the marginalized, reached out to those who were rejected in society. Love that brought healing and was life-giving, brought wholeness. People encountered forgiveness and acceptance and value when they met with Jesus. They experienced healing of all kinds, physical, emotional, spiritual, mental. People found real life, eternal life in Jesus. Peter says that in the book of Acts that it was well known that Jesus went around doing good. We read in the gospel accounts, some of the religious leaders used to try and trick Jesus and get him to say the wrong thing. And he would see through that and was widely respected as someone who did good, who did the right thing. He was a good man, even if people kind of grudgingly accepted that. We know he kept the law. Jesus said he didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. But he wasn't legalistic. He put people first, fulfilling the spirit of the law, not just the technicalities of it. Jesus' life was full of love, and it was also characterized by servanthood and sacrifice. Jesus described himself as a servant. He demonstrated what servanthood is like by washing his disciples' feet, a very lowly act. He was humble. You see stories of him going to parties where he's clearly not the guest of honor. He took that lowly station. He withdrew from people when they tried to make him king or anything like that. He refused to use his power for his own advantage. He didn't amass any wealth. He didn't try to control people. Rather, he allowed himself to be rejected, to be arrested, to be tortured, and to be put to death, ultimately. Jesus is a perfect example of a life of integrity. But we expect that, right? I mean, that's Jesus. And I think it's tempting to kind of dismiss that as being impossible for us. We'll never be like that. Certainly, we're not going to be like that overnight. We're on a journey. It's a process. And it can seem slow sometimes. But we are called to be salt and light. We're called to live a life of love that brings healing and life to others. We're called to do good and not to get tired of doing good. We're called to servanthood and to sacrifice our own desires and our own wants for other people, for the sake of others. The early church took this call to be salt and light seriously. The book of James in the Bible is a letter believed by many commentators to have been written by James, the brother of Jesus, who was the leader of the church in Jerusalem. Or if it wasn't by him, it was written in the style of him or in his honor. And the letter quotes part of the Sermon on the Mount verbatim. And it's focused on what does this really look like for us? What does it mean to live out this teaching in our daily life? It's not about what do we believe so much as how do we live? How do we live as salt and as light? How do we live in a society that doesn't value love that much? There isn't a whole lot of love. There isn't a whole lot of integrity. What does that mean for us? James, the leader of the church in Jerusalem, was also known as James the Just or James the Righteous. Eusebius was a 4th century church historian, and he wrote that James, I think we have this quote, yeah, used to enter alone into the temple and be found kneeling and praying for forgiveness for the people, so that his knees grew hard like a camel's because of his constant worship of God. So from his excessive righteousness, he was called the Just. It's Nothing worse than camel knees, right? So I don't pray too much. I don't want to get camel knees. But no, Josephus was a first century historian, and he records that James was put to death on the orders of the high priest in AD 62, and that the Jewish community leaders actually protested quite strongly about that, saying that that was a wrong thing to do. So it seems that James was not only religious, and he was in the temple, and he was praying, but he was really widely respected, not just by the followers of Jesus, not just by the early church, but by the larger Jewish society too. So this was a good man who was doing good. And this is what James the Just writes. Next one. Get rid of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent, and humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save you. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and, after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they've heard but doing it, they will be blessed in what they do. Those who consider themselves religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues deceive themselves, and their religion is worthless. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. So according to James, there's no point at all in just listening to what Jesus said unless we also put it into practice by watching what we say, by caring for the vulnerable and the marginalized, and by staying pure, staying not polluted, staying salty, living that life of love, not just doing what we see other people doing. This is according to the word that's planted within us, James said. It's not about adhering to external laws. It's about the Spirit of Christ within us, leading us to lead a consistently loving life, a life of integrity. And this focus of living a life of integrity and a life of love, of course, didn't stop with the early church. Many individuals, many movements have taken up this challenge. The Puritan leader, John Winthrop, for example, specifically references that part of the Sermon on the Mount, the need to be a light, the need to be a city on a hill, when he and his community set out for New England in 1630. And he articulated the desire that this community would be one that held everything in common, all their possessions in common, like the first church did in Acts 2, that would follow those words of Micah, that prophet in the Jewish scriptures that we often quote, to do justly, love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. That community would listen to the exhortation of Moses to always choose life, not death, good versus evil. And if you read those writings of the early Puritans, there is this passionate desire to live with integrity, to follow Jesus in every part of their life. But of course, to call someone puritanical today is an insult. And many Puritans we know did become very judgmental and very legalistic. Last summer, my family and I went up to Salem, and we did quite a bit of reading on the witch trials. We did the history tours, the walking tours, and we watched a reenactment of one of the trials. The kids thought it was very cool, you know, entertaining. But actually, I found it deeply disturbing. I actually got quite upset about it until my exasperated 15-year-old said, "Mom, it was more than 300 years ago. Get over it already." Which, you know, he had a point, I guess. But I found it deeply disturbing because when you read about them, these were good people. Or it seemed like they were good people. It seemed like people who really wanted to follow God. They wanted to serve God well. They wanted to do the right thing. And yet they ended up hanging 19 people as witches. They ended up imprisoning a 4-year-old in total darkness for 9 months till she went insane. And you just think, what happened? They wanted to do everything right. They wanted their community to be pure, to be righteous. But they lost all sight of love. And I think that's actually one of the dangers with this tradition. Obviously not that we're going to go out and call one another witches and put each other to death. Obviously this is an extreme example, and there was lots of theories about what else was at play here, whether that was mass hysteria or whether that was ergot poisoning from the rye bread or, you know, whatever. There's lots of theories about that. Clearly this is exceptional example. But ironically, I do think that the desire to live a good life can sometimes drive out love. It can make us fearful of becoming polluted, as James put it, of becoming impure. It can make us self-righteous and proud. It can make us judgmental to anyone who doesn't see things quite the way we do. Another Christian tradition that focused on living this life of integrity was known as the Holiness Movement. Brian talked about this a little bit last week and mentioned that that was something that was part of his upbringing. It began primarily in the Methodist Church with John Wesley, who started that movement in the 18th century, a little bit before Brian's time. But he had a real concern that that the church had really failed people in not addressing how they lived. That it was okay to focus on what people believed, but it also mattered how they lived. So he set up small groups that would hold each other accountable for how they lived and that would focus on discipleship, on real practical ways of following Jesus. He also got involved in setting up schools and orphanages, in campaigning against slavery, in campaigning for prison reform. He promoted women as preachers. He spoke out against the dangers of drinking too much alcohol. He taught classes on how to earn and save and spend money wisely, very practical day-to-day stuff. And John Wesley expected people who claimed to be saved to actually live a transformed life, a life of integrity. He wrote this, "By salvation, I mean not barely, according to the vulgar notion, deliverance from hell or going to heaven, but a present deliverance from sin, a restoration of the soul to its primitive health, its original purity, a recovery of the divine nature, the renewal of our souls after the image of God in righteousness and true holiness, in justice, mercy, and truth." And I think John Wesley is a really interesting model of integrity because although we tend to look back now and think of him as this great leader and reformer, this man of really strong passion and great faith, he didn't always feel that way. In fact, after he'd been a preacher for about, well, more than 10 years, he confided to a good friend that he'd never actually had a sense of intimacy with God. We looked at intimacy a couple of weeks ago now, so you might remember that. That was actually our snow day. So if you missed it, there is, as we mentioned last week, there is a video online. You can watch that. But Wesley, this great man of faith, didn't have that sense of intimacy with God. And he was pretty depressed about it. You know, he's trying to do all these great things, but he felt, well, you know, it just can't be enough because I really don't feel that connection with God in that way. And he was concerned that maybe he should just quit. Maybe he didn't have enough faith. He should stop being a preacher. And his friend counseled him, don't give up. Preach faith till you have it. And then because you have it, you will preach faith. And 2 months later, he went to a service. And while he was listening to the message, he had some kind of an experience. And he later recorded in his journal, "I felt my heart strangely warmed." He realized, and I quote, "It is not Christ and good works, but Christ alone who saves, resulting in good works." So John Wesley was committed to living rightly, to helping others live rightly, to live with integrity. But he realized that at that moment that it wasn't that was going to make God accept him and love him and win God's favor, that he had that already. That John Wesley's integrity didn't save him, but the fact that he was saved, the fact that he knew he was accepted and loved by God, that led to that inner transformation, that inner wholeness that enabled him to live a life of integrity. Wesley also had continued to be faithful for 10 years, more than 10 years, even when he didn't feel like it, even when he was depressed about it and felt distant from God. And I think that's another aspect of integrity, of being consistent, being undivided, even when we don't feel like it. And we've talked before about the hiddenness of God, how sometimes it can be hard to see God as being very present, how we don't always feel that sense of intimacy with God, particularly sometimes when times are hard. And I know I've shared this quote before, but it's one of my favorites. I'd credit it with keeping me on track more than once in my own life. It's from a book by C.S. Lewis called Screwtape Letters, which was written, obviously it's fiction, it was written as a conversation between a senior demon called Screwtape and a junior attempt to call Wormwood. And Screwtape is giving Wormwood instructions about how to thwart the plans of the enemy, i.e. God. And this was what Screwtape writes. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks around upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. How do we behave when no one's looking? How do we behave when it feels like maybe God is not even looking? I think maybe that is the test of our integrity. Living out our values is, of course, something that's very important to us here at Cedar Ridge. It's a central part of our vision and discipleship. That practical following Jesus in our everyday lives is something that we focus on quite a lot. In our vision, we have these sentences. Imagine a community of people devoted to following Jesus together, learning to live like him and helping one another grow in their relationship with God, where we are gradually transformed to become better people, better friends, better family members, better workers, better neighbors, becoming people who enjoy life to the full and who can also deal with adversity well, learning to grow through failure and suffering. We want to be more like Jesus. Not by following a set of rules or just trying really, really hard, but by being gradually transformed from within. And we want that to impact every part of our lives, our work life, our family life, our community life. We want that to affect everything. We're committed to following Jesus, and we know that requires effort. We often describe it as being on a journey. We haven't arrived for sure, but we hope we're making progress. We're intentionally trying to. We're putting one foot in front of the other. We're not just sitting back and waiting for transformation to just happen to us. So how do we go about helping or facilitating this process of transformation? How do we live a life of increasing integrity? In Romans 12, Paul, one of the early church leaders, writes this. So here's what I want you to do, God helping you. Take your everyday, ordinary life, your sleeping, eating, going to work, and walking around life, and place it before God as an offering. Embracing what God does for you is the best thing you can do for him. Don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God, and you'll be changed from the inside out. Fix your attention on God. Jesus says something similar in John 15. Live in me. Make your home in me just as I do in you. In the same way that a branch cannot bear grapes by itself, but only by being joined to the vine, you can't bear fruit unless you are joined with me. I am the vine. You are the branches. When you're joined with me and I with you, the relation intimate and organic, the harvest is sure to be abundant. We are transformed when we fix our attention on God, when we live in and make our home in Jesus, or remain in Jesus, some other versions have. And we can practice this remaining in Jesus, this fixing our attention on God in various ways, through prayer, through meditating on scripture, through being mindful of our oneness with God. And we've talked about some of those practices in other messages and in other series, and some of them are laid out in the annex in the materials. So if you haven't still picked up the materials, there are some more copies in the commons. I'd suggest you get those. But as we connect with God, we may begin to identify areas of our lives that feel like they are a little inconsistent with our values, areas where maybe our conscience is not too easy, or we just feel like we're not really being our true self. How consistent is our life? I think it's good to actually take some time and stop and really ask ourselves that. How consistent in those different areas of our life? And some questions that might help us to assess that are these. Are there areas where we're not honest? Areas where we're not honest with ourselves? Or where we're not honest with other people, where we know we're not completely, you know, straight about things, that's probably a sign that we're not, don't have integrity there. Are there areas of our lives where we lack empathy? I think sometimes we can get caught up in living our values, but from our own perspective, and not really going beyond that to see how does what I do, how does what I say and how I act impact other people? Maybe there are situations where we find it hard to exercise self-control, where we act on impulse rather than stopping and thinking through how do I live out my values in this situation. And maybe there are areas where we fail to take responsibility or be proactive. Maybe we're not actually doing anything wrong, but we're not really living out our values in a very proactive way. I think some of us are more drawn to this kind of a perspective of God. We really want to do what's right, and we wanted to do that consistently, maybe with the kind of people who stop and think, well, what would Jesus do before we respond to situations throughout the day? And if you're like that, I think that's great. It's really fantastic. At the same time, though, we need to remember that this is just part of the spectrum. You remember that graphic we had of the light going through the water. Discipleship, following Jesus, is not just about me and how I behave. It's not just about my personal growth. Again, this is something Brian touched on last week. It's not just about me. It's bigger than me. And I think that's actually one of the great things about the Cedar Ridge vision, is that we place growth, we place that personal transformation in the context of community and servanthood. Rather than becoming absorbed in, how am I doing today kind of a thing, potentially becoming self-righteous or proud, or if we think we're doing a terrible job of that, becoming pretty disillusioned. Instead, we work on growth together in community. We meet for mutual support, mutual encouragement, and accountability. And we look for God's transformation in one another. Sometimes it can be easier to see it in other people than in ourselves, and we want to encourage one another like that. We also want to pursue justice alongside one another, again, which is what we looked at last week. So growth, that personal transformation, community and servanthood, we need all three. We want more of that spectrum. We don't want to just focus down on one element of that spectrum. We're going to take communion together now, and I think in many ways, communion is a call to integrity. Jesus said, whenever you eat the bread or drink from the cup, remember me. Not just whenever at your religious gathering, remember me. But remember me also in all your eating and drinking. Remember me when you're eating breakfast and you're yelling at the kids because they're going too slow, you know? Remember me when you're in the break room at work. Remember me when you're taking a moment for yourself to have a coffee. Remember me, remember Jesus' boundless love, that life of love and integrity all throughout the day, all throughout our lives. Make that an integral part of your day. But we also spend time here coming together intentionally as a community to eat and drink and remember Jesus together as a symbol that we are one. That we're one with each other and we're one with God. We are branches of that true vine. Together we are fixing our attention on God. Together we are committing to abiding in God, to remaining in Jesus, to being changed from the inside out. Together we want to support and encourage each other to be salt and light and to live our values. So let's pray together. Jesus, you call us to follow you in every aspect of our lives. And sometimes that can seem daunting and difficult and exhausting. But we thank you that you don't just leave it to us, that you are one with us, that you empower us, that you are with us and in us in that, that you are transforming us from the inside out. We thank you that we are one with you, that we can make our home in you, that you have made your home in us. Help us to live lives of integrity. Help us not to grow weary of doing good, of being salt and light. We know there's so much of life that we don't control, so much of that screen, as it were, that we don't control, but help us in our corner to do what we can to live out our values and to live a life of love that reflects the incredible love that you have for us and for our world. Amen. I'm going to take some time now to respond. You can come and receive communion, serve yourselves at the tables at the side or in the middle, or be served by the servers at the side. You can also pray with someone at the back. If there's something you'd like to pray about, we'd love to do that. You can also write out a prayer and put it in the frames at the back, and a team of people will pray for you during the week. You can make a financial offering, light a candle, sit quietly, or sing along with the music. So when you're ready, please feel free to respond.